Thank you again, Rabbi Eli Rubin, the principal of Kushner, and one of our members, and it's always great to have him. Next week is Rabbi Maccabi Avishur. He's Center for Jewish...
I think he works in...
YU...
Prisma. YU merged.
Well, they merged. Yeah, and Center for Jewish Day Schools, I don't know. But he works in at YU and at other organizations, a member of our shul. And then Rabbi Adler in 2 weeks. Okay. All right, without further ado.
Okay, thank you very much. And really, all extra credit for everybody here. You're exempt from any other shiurim for coming out at 22 degrees. Well, it's my shiur, so I win. Okay, you're not exempt, but you get the front row the next time, or the back row. Really one of my favorite parshiot, because it has a lot of relevance to many of the conversations that we would have in modern times. And I want to break this up a little bit just into two parts. One is to go into some of the pshat in the psukim, and then an overview comparison between the beginning of the parsha and the end of the parsha. So I know I don't have that much time to make these two mini shiurim work, but hopefully we'll have enough time to combine them. Of course, they are related because it's going to be the same themes. So starting off just in the beginning of the parsha, we know that Yaakov went ahead and he embraced Esav when he was on his way from Lavan back to Eretz Yisrael. Maybe you're aware of it, and if you are, I'm sorry for being repetitive to things that you may know, but it's actually not received unanimously among Chazal whether or not this was a good strategy on Yaakov's point. So just as an different looks at it. The first, I brought a midrashan from the Yalkut Shimoni, his little arrow next to the left. Amar Rav Yonatan, kol mi shrotzeh l'ratzot melech o shilton ve'ein yodeh darkam b'tachsiseim. If you want to appease or placate a king, and you don't understand the cultures and the protocols, yaniach parsha zulafanav, put this parsha right there in front of him, v'yulmod ha'imena techasim piusim v'ritzuyim. And you can learn from Yaakov how to deal with what could be a hostile authority. If you look at the next medrash, which is from Esther Rabbah, it's an interesting story that's related about Mordechai, that how come he didn't bow down in front of Haman. That's an interesting story in and of its own. Did Mordechai have a right to put the Jewish people in danger for what ostensibly was not a crime of Yahareg Bal Yavor? You don't have to be killed for it. That's why the Medrash came up with these different alternative explanations that Haman had an Avodah Zarah hanging on his neck. For those who remember that, because the Medrash, the halacha concept is a little difficult, how Mordechai put all the people in danger. But it's interesting that Mordechai is asked, Madu ato ve'eret mitzvat ha-melech, Rabbi Levi Amar, Mordechai Moshe Rabbeinu v'zir lem b'torah, arur ha'ish she'aseh pesul ma'asecha. The Rosh Hashanah sets Ma'avodah Zarah. So this, you can't bow down to Haman because he made himself into an idol. B'yesheyo anavi yiziranu chidlu lechem min adam asher neshama b'yapo ki v'men nachshavu. V'lo hod el shani etzdak yiran shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu shekol ha'shvatim noldu b'chutz la'aretz. So Mordechai said, first you can't bow down because he made himself into a Avodah Zarah. But then he had something interesting. All of the tribes bowed down to Esav because they were all born in Chutz La'aretz. They were born outside of Eretz Yisrael. Uzekeini nolad be'Eretz Yisrael. My great-great-great-grandfather was born in Eretz Yisrael. Who was Mordechai's great-great-great-grandfather?
Shaul,
which comes from?
Kish.
Kish, which comes from Shev Binyamin. Binyamin was born right by Beit Lechem. So Mordechai, as if Mordechai was saying, the reason why all of those Chutz La'aretz Jews were bowing down is because they had a gullet mentality. But I am an Eretz Yisrael Jew, and this type of Jewish renaissance doesn't bow down to Haman. By the way, I'm always careful as much as I can not to create any time alienate anybody with a point of view. I don't own history or any interpretation, but just I think it's fair to comment that after the Holocaust, there was a lot of tension between those of the Sabra Israeli Jews and those who survived the Holocaust, exactly around this concept. There was a lot of judgmentalism going on about the survivors who survived the war versus those who saw themselves as the new Jew, the hero, the strong, the muscular, the tan, the drying up the boats people. And it didn't change. According to some historians, it really didn't change until the Eichmann trial until 1962, when it became very apparent to what extent the Nazis had taken over the European continent, and the Jews were forced into. And there's this tension is found right over here by Binyamin. The Ramban quotes the midrash. I know I'm speaking quickly, so I'm sorry. But I don't think it's not. Let's finish the midrash. Ve'yigid l'man amalo haman amrun l'zkenu el ishtachav l'zkeni hadadim. But tigash nashpachot v'achak nigash l'sev rachel v'ishtachavu. Avalon alad binyamin. And Binyamin was not born. The Ramban takes a very interesting approach to this. Knowing the Ramban and his approach to exegesis, you would probably assume the Ramban is critical. And you'd be right. So the Ramban quotes the Medrash, and we're going to go backwards in this Ramban. You see there are two paragraphs. The second paragraph, we're going to start from the second paragraph, and if we have time, we'll circle back to the first paragraph. It's not critical to this in this part of the shiur. El Esav el Achiv Aser Atzasei, Bavur Heot Negev Eretz Yisrael Al Yedei Adom, Baviv Yosheb Eretz HaNegev, Yesh Lo Lavor Derech Adom O Kurov Misham, Al Kein Pachad Ulai Yishma Esav. He was afraid that Esav would hear that he was coming. V'higdim l'shloach ilav malachim l'artzo. And he therefore sent messengers to Esav to say, I'm on my way. He tried to get ahead of it, as they would say today in the marketing community. He wanted to preempt it and saying, Esav, I'm on my way to Eretz Israel. I'm coming. I want to appease you. V'kfar tafsuhu hachachamim alzeh. And he's been very criticized by the rabbinic commentaries. Amar Reisha Rabba machzik ba'aznei hakelev. Yaakov was criticized for holding on to the dog by his ears, which was, in other words, he provoked Esav. Amalo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, L'darko hayam ma'alach, v'ayam mishalech etzlov, v'omer l'ko amar avdecha Yaakov, v'yal dati gam zeh yomoz, ki anachnu hitchalna nefilatana b'yad edom, ki malchi bayit sheni bo bebritim haromayim. The Ramban, which is consistent with his approach to all of Bereshit, is that it's Masa Avot Simen Labanim. Yaakov had no business arousing the anger of Esav by trying to appease him. He should have just avoided him altogether. And by provoking him into an engagement, it put himself and his family into danger. And he said that these alliances that we make, I'm not alluding to anything, as the Ramban said, the alliances that the Jews made in the Bayit Sheni with the warring brothers also ultimately led to the destruction of the Bayit Sheni, because we got ourselves into the middle of a conflict of great major powers, which we could have avoided. So some of the Medrash looks at Yaakov that he was great what he did, and some of the Medrash looks at Yaakov and the Ramban that he should have really avoided as much as he can Esav. And of course then there's that semi-shita that says that it didn't matter what he did because he should have come in very strong, which now brings me to the second part, or the part 1A or 1B. The beginning of the parsha is Yaakov. First is the Rashi. Let's take a look at the where Yash Rashi. Let's take from the beginning of the parsha. Veishlach malchim lafanav Esav arta seir vayesedam gatoh Laban garti, and he says, I'm going to come back and I'm living with Laban. Very nice midrashim on this. Pasuk Zayin. Vayeshuvu malchim. The malachim return. These are messengers. Banu elachicha el Esav. You see the redundancy. Banu elachicha el Esav. For those of you who are students of Chumash, may want to look into this. V'gam holech lekratcha v'arba'amot ish imo. Also, if we had time to develop this, there seems some words here that need to be some explication. And he's coming towards us with 400 people. Clearly a declaration of war. V'yira Yaakov ma'od v'yetzer lo. So, let's see the translation of our friend, the Rabbi Otzko. He became frightened and distressed. Students of the Chumash know that this seems to be redundancy. Why was he frightened, and what were the two languages of fear? Vayira Yaakov ma'od, vayetzer lo. He was fearful and he was distressed. What is the nuanced difference between these two descriptions? If you're not familiar with it, take a look at Rashi. And Rashi opens up something here which is actually quite significant. It's at the top of the page, Pasuk Ched. If you don't have Rashi, it's okay. Vayira Shema Yehareg. He was frightened that maybe he would be killed. Vayetzer lo im yaharog hu et acherim. He was fearful that he would kill others. Does that sit well with you? He was fearful that he'd be killed. Understandable. Or he was fearful that he'd be kill others. Why would he be fearful to kill others? This is a good time for you to answer if you want. What? Oh, that the that we'll only have peace when the Arabs. That explains that a little more. For those who don't know, you're talking about the Arabs.
Golden Bear syndrome. We can
Can't turn, forgive you, just doesn't kill you. Okay. Anyone else want to take a shot at? Maybe that's the wrong word. Why was he? What was he afraid of?
You want to kill somebody.
Similar to what he said, the Golden Meir syndrome. So there's interesting conversation around this issue. So firstly, Abarbanel says something fascinating. Yeah, I have the Abarbanel here printed. If you don't have the page, it's okay. Because it's not necessary. We're not going to read that much inside. You can take it home. In fact, since not everybody has, I won't even read it. It's not fair. Wow. You copied it all by hand?
First time.
Oh. If you take a look at page 2, the upside down printing, the Abarbanel is the bottom of the page. It's this. Just to save time, it's the second column on the top side. And v'hulo chashash the devar zeh avalach shavo shelo yamut lo yikra gibor. Someone who is not afraid of dying is not considered a strong hero person. A warrior should be afraid of death. V'chein mishim efazer momono yoter midai lo yikare nadiv. A person who is irresponsible fiscally and spreads money out without any concern, and then gives a lot of charity also, shouldn't be considered magnanimous. Ki lo asa ze letov b'chirato, ela mibnei heyoto mivaze et hamamon. A person who spends irresponsibly is not doing so because of he is generous or magnanimous or benevolent. He doesn't have any respect or reverence for money. Ulechein ra'ui legibor she'yitatzev min hamavet. A hero should be frightened to die. And he continues going and says that a true warrior is someone who fears death. Because otherwise it's going against the natural instinct. So Vayiralo would be he's afraid to die, which makes him a hero. It says Vayetzer lo, there's a lot of comments on it. So the Maharal, who gives a commentary in Chumash, speaks to this issue of Vayetzer lo, and there are two parts that I want to talk about the Maharal. The first, he says, is there was collateral damage. I didn't give you enough time to process this. Maybe there'd be collateral damage. In other words, Yaakov is coming with 400 people. Was he able to ascertain among the 400 people that all of them were warriors? All of them were intent on killing? Can he possibly have done some sort of a test of aggression to determine who was a killer, who was a warrior, and who was an innocent civilian? Sounds very familiar of today's time. How do you determine civilian deaths and war crimes? And he was afraid that he would kill people who may be innocent. So according to Rashi, there is an element in wartime of being careful and being very sensitive to the issues of innocents who may be collateral, who may be killed, but without really focus, without understanding their true identity. Interesting point. This is not universally accepted. There is a minchat chinuch, which it's a maral. I take it back. The maral says later on that there is perhaps a different way to look at it. We're going to skip to that a little later, but at this moment here, when we're at this point of Yaakov and we're at this point of Esav, let's just keep it as a bookmark. That according to Rashi and according to the Maral, there has to be extra sensitivity for those who would be considered collateral damage or unintended consequences. A very important point. In any event, just getting back and further back into this, the psukim continue, and he says, "Vayirlo, vayetzlo, vayachetz et ha'amasher ito, betatzon betavara v'lu shnei machanot." And he says, "I'll be two camps." So Rashi again here dominates with a really important theme. Anybody remember the Rashi that he prepared himself really for three different eventualities or contingency plans? So if you continue looking in the Chumash, he'll say that if one camp will be attacked, one will escape. And then he says, Katonti mikol ha-chasidim, mikol ha-met. And he starts to pray, Hatzileni na miyad achi miyad esav. Here also, Hatzileni na miyad achi miyad esav. Why the double language? Hatzileni na miyad achi miyad esav. It fits right in very nicely into the explanation we just gave. Give it a little thought. Maybe Hatzileni na miyad achi miyad esav. Why the duality? Yes. Exactly. Exactly. You hear the sensitivity. Hatzileni na miyad achi. Now this is a stretch, admittedly. Maybe it's a bit homiletic. Hatzileni na miyad achi. Save me from killing my brother. I don't want to be in a circumstance where I have to kill those who'd be considered non-combatants. Or Esav, save me from Esav killing us. I admittedly I'm reading into it, but I think that with a little bit of a kvetch, it certainly could be consistent with the original comment of Vayir lo Vayetzer, where there is also that double language of Yaakov's fear or concern, or some ambivalence that really made him feel very, very uncomfortable. The last part of this is the whole camp idea. And you should know that there are several latter-day commentaries, even those before the Holocaust, and the Ramban himself will say this later on, that this is another indication of the future viability and the sustainability and the eternal value of the Jewish people. That even if one camp would be wiped out, there will always be HaMachaneh HaNishar L'Fleita. That no matter how much the Jewish people suffer in one part of the world, we'll always have a remnant that will revive the Jewish people in another part of the world. And in fact, the Ramban, who we know lived long before the worst of tragedies that ever befell the Jewish people, says this in relationship to the fight, the wrestling match with the Malach. Anybody think back about the Malach, which is coming right now? He meets the Malach in the middle of the night. Very, very difficult story to understand just from its straight reading of the text. But nevertheless, reading it straight from the text, he has some sort of a encounter with the Malach. This encounter Malach goes on all night long, Vayaveki Shimo Adalot HaShachar, and he gets up in the morning, and he asks him, who are you? Remember the story he doesn't want to say, Vayarki Lo Yacholo. The Malach saw the bottom of page 174. He gets it and says, I can't vanquish you. I can't defeat you. You are. It's the eternity of Yaakov. It's the inner strength. It's the fight in Yaakov that did not permit him to be defeated. So he injured the inside of his thigh, and therefore Yaakov was limping. And Ramban says that this too is symbolic of the Jewish people's trajectory. We would have all sorts of struggles with unidentified enemies that would come close to really unfortunately defeating us, and they may bring us to a point of injury, of weakness, of being wounded and limping, but we will always be victorious. And the Ramban wrote this, obviously, long before he understood the complexity of Jewish history as it unfolded in medieval Europe and also culminating in the Holocaust. I'm saying this very I'm not saying it apologetically, but I'm saying because my father said it to me and it left a very big impression on me when he said it, even though my father had a very complex religious personality. He wasn't the lonely man of faith, but he was certainly a complicated man of faith. And he said to me that, and I mentioned this before in a different venue of a shir, he said he knew the Satmar Rebbe, he was very close to the Hasidic community. He said that was one of the underlying reasons that got the Hasidic, the Satmar Rebbe, to reach the conclusion that Medina Yisrael should be absolutely forbidden. Because he said that if you concentrate Jews, what we learned from the war, that if you concentrate too many Jews in one place, you make us vulnerable. He said, therefore, but if you take back that medrash that we just said about Binyamin, you can see the mentality of a diaspora mind. The mentality of a diaspora mind would be, sure, you make ourselves vulnerable if you apply the attitude of Jews who are living in the diaspora. But for the whole resurgence and the renaissance of the Jewish people in Israel, we said we will be the strong, vibrant nation with vitality and never be vulnerable because we are going to be in Eretz Israel. But that flip was never done by many of the European Hasidic community, and said, therefore, the Jewish people should always have these different camps. And Rav Shimshon Falosh also says it. Of course, he lived before the Holocaust, but he also said the Jews should be split up and spread out, which, by the way, we're going to come to also at the end of the class. So I hope we get to that, because there's a lot of interesting comments that's going to come from these comments. They're not standalone pieces. So we have Yaakov representing, in fact, if you look back at the Ramban in the first page, which I said I don't know if we'd have time to look at, but if you have Ramban in the first page, Nichtava ha-parsha hazot le'odia ki etziel HaKadosh Baruch Hu et avdo v'galo miyad chazak mimeno v'yishalach malacha v'yatzileu lamdeinu o shu lo batach b'tzidkato. I'm sorry, v'yesh b'zeh od remez l'dorot. This is going to be a hint to all generations. Ki kol asher irala avinu imesav achiv yeyarei lanu tamid im b'nei Esav. We will always be in battle and conflict with the descendants of Esav. V'ra'ui lanu le'echoz b'darko shel tzadik. And we should be very mindful of how this tzadik responded. Shenazmin atzmenu l'shloshet hadvarim shezmin uzu l'tfila. Yaakov prepared himself with prayer. Doron and Hatzalah k'derech milchama. I like that the Ramban adds that. It's not just Hatzalah. He said we need three characteristics of Yaakov in all of our encounters with Bnei Esav. Prayer, Doron would be gifts. I would liken that to diplomacy. So that was the way I would modernize that word Doron. It's okay. It's not such a far off idea. Okay, you don't have to like it. It's gifts. It's a form of diplomacy, like sending... I'm not saying anything. Ul Hatzalah and Kederach Milchama. By the way, I always think very parenthetically that Moshe Rabbeinu missed this message. I know this is very parenthetical and it's confusing this year not to say in Yaakov, but bear with me if you don't get it, it's parenthetical. How did Moshe Rabbeinu miss this message? I have a little reference to this. I was always very fond of when I got there. You won't see it here. You remember when the Jews were standing on the banks of the Yam Suf? And the Mitzrim were chasing them, and the Jewish people started panicking. And Moshe says to them, Hashem yilachem lachem v'atem tacharishun, don't worry, God will fight for you, and then you'll just remain silent. There's some commentary conflict, remain silent, stop arguing and bickering with me, or remain silent, don't worry, I have it under control. The very next pasuk there is, Ma titzak alai, what are you screaming at me? Daber b'nei Yisrael v'yisau. It's almost as if Moshe Rabbeinu prepared himself with only one of these attributes of prayer. And didn't take the Yaakov lesson of Hatzalah by running, which is what Hashem said, or going to war. And this is what the Ramban says. I always thought that Moshe Rabbeinu had a transition from the Moshe Rabbeinu of the miracle man to the Moshe Rabbeinu at the end of that parsha with Yehoshua and Amalek. There's a lot of growth in that parsha when Amalek comes, and then he figures out that he's got to set up a general and has to go out and fight Amalek. Anyway, that's just a parenthetical comment. So this is the frame number one. Frame number one is we have Yaakov. Did he do the right thing by reaching out, extending himself to Esav? Some say yes, some say he should have avoided it. What could we learn from Yaakov? He prepared himself appropriately, and he was very responsible about the future of his family by splitting up the camp into three. We also learn about Yaakov is that he was fearful of dying in battle, which was a good thing, we said, the Abarbanel. That makes someone into a real hero. And at the same time, taking the moral is that he was also fear killing those who may be innocent, what we would today call war crimes or killing innocent civilians. We're going to see later on in the parasha that there's another way to look at this. That's why I keep on emphasizing it. The fourth thing we mentioned was that Yaakov fought with the Malach all night long, which is symbolic of the way that the Jewish people will survive throughout all the years of the diaspora, that wherever we are, we may be wounded, we may be limping, we may be injured and hurt, but we will always survive, we will always thrive. In fact, when I speak to older students in the high school level, I always say to them that it's unfortunate, but one of the greatest ways to take inspiration about the Jewish people and the veracity of Torah is looking at Jewish history and recognizing the impossibility of survival at the same time how we thrive. And someone who is a serious student of Jewish history cannot but recognize that there is a miraculous component within the Jewish people's survival which defies all sorts of rational logic. And it's hard to really get there until you can see the sequence of Jewish history and see the events, how we've really ended up where we are without really taking some sort of being astonished Now, how do you interpret that astonishment? As I also think has also been a focus of some of the enemies of the Jewish people for many years, which, of course, is a different chapter in itself. The end of this parsha, yes, sir. Have to go? Oh.
Just with all due respect to the Maharal,
yeah.
It's an ace of the classic Rode. And there's so many other points with the halacha that were sensitized to you know, how we act during the war and the fruit tree. You have the mitzvah today, you have to be careful.
Right.
So, right, there are plenty of examples how not to have wanton killing or destruction. But this is probably not one of those examples. Ace of is coming to 400 people. It's a classic Rode. The response is do something, do something positive, and not be concerned that, oh, it's going to be
So I certainly don't disagree with you. I think the Maharal doesn't own this interpretation. Remember, the Maharal's comment is based on Rashi. This is the Maharal in Rashi called the Gur Aryeh. It's the Maharal's job in Gur Aryeh was always to support Rashi. He was like watching a news channel that always supports one political point of view. That no matter what that candidate did, it's okay, because that's what we do. So the Maharal was supporting Rashi, but I understand, I mean, I read the Maharal inside, I didn't give you the benefit of reading it, you should go check it out. The Maharal said that you don't know that among the 400, there weren't another 200 people that were just stragglers, that they were not combatants, they were not enemies. Maybe their wives were with them. Who are these 400 people? Esav was a Rodef. 50 of them were Rodefim. How do you know about the other ones? So there's a sensitivity. I think that that in itself is a very high level of concern that warriors should take into consideration. But I understand. Because I mean, you'll see, at the end of the parasha, the morale will contradict this, but from a different perspective. Now, with all this is a frame, just to get to the, not just to, but now to continue at the end of the parsha, my second half of this class. And I thank you for staying awake and being with me. Really, I'm very honored. If you take a look at the end of the parsha, we have a really, it's a shocking story of Dina. It's a shocking story. And Vatetze Dina, let's open it all up. Maybe Dr. Friedman will go down and photocopy all the Chumashim for us.
Well, I'll just go over there.
No, just joking. Perek Lamed Daled, page 180, if you have the Chumash in front of you. Vateitze Dina, or Vateitze Dina, Bat Lea, Asher Yeldal Yaakov, Lerot Bivnot Haaretz. And Dina left. Where did she go? I had once an insight into the, but I once put together a kind of a sequence of time, in a shir, the word say, as it relates in the book of Bereshit. Or in other places also. And the word say is always in, for instance, by Noach, say min ha-teva. That's what got me thinking about it, is that Noach didn't want to leave the ark. And that say is always in response to something, and it has to be, there's something that has to force, and it's a little complex to say it by Dina, because it could be a little misinterpreted, but what was Dina doing going out to Livnot Baaretz? Because we can't blame the victim. It's very important to remember that. She is a victim no matter what she did. And I have to say that if you go through Chazal, it's pretty fair that everyone respects that and recognizes, even though she put herself in danger, she was still a victim of this horrific story. So, Vateitze Dina Lerot Bivnot Taaretz, Asher Adal Yaakov Reb Bivnot Taaretz, Vayarot Hashchem Ben Chamor Achivi, Nasi Aretz, Vayikachota Vayishkavota Vayaneha. So not only did he rape her, but he also really inflicted all sorts of pain, which is thankfully is a little bit obscure within the Chumash. So if you skip down to the kind of like the end of the story, there's a lot of trickery, there's a lot of deception here, and they make all these negotiations, and Yaakov is part of the negotiation, and he's even part of the deception that all of the Shechem people should have Brit Milah, ostensibly. I'm giving you the end of it. I'm commentary, but I think it's really almost it's clear. It jumps at you from the verses. Yaakov is okay with this plan, that everyone would have to have some. They have to go into this surgical procedure of circumcision, so they would be weak enough and they can save Dina. If you would ask me, that's what Yaakov agreed to. Yaakov only agreed to the plan of the circumcision, and they would capture Dina, and they would escape and run for the hills. Remember, Yaakov's mentality may have been the same mentality, and I'm giving it away a little, of bowing down to Esav and make Vishtacha Vluart Paimartza. He never agreed to the plan of Shimon of Levi, which was when they were convalescing and they were sick. that they would go out and murder or kill, depending on which adjective you, which verb you would use, depending on the commentary. One of the Rambam verses would say they would defend Dina by killing all the people in the city, and the Ramban would say murdered all the people in the city. And there is a diverse, a lot of room for interpretation here. But we know Yaakov is upset with this. Yaakov is not happy. We know this in two places. The first place we know is under the story. So let's see what happens. Anashim el shlamim itanu. And if you can look down, Vayi biyomer shlishi, so it's page 184. Vayi biyomer shlishi biyotam koavim vayikhu shnei v'nei Yaakov shimon v'levi achedina. By the way, I think that achedina is a beautiful term. That they were, but I'm going to contradict this again, because I think that's what any good shir should do. We should never leave any comment unquestioned. Achedina, they came from a place of brethren, of fraternity, of defense of their sister. Ish charbo v'yabo alayir betach, confident and resolute. With vayargu kol zachar, that chamor v'shchem b'no hargu l'feichar, when they killed the enemy and the aggressor. Vayichu edina v'beit shchem v'yetzu, and they left. B'nei Yaakov bo al chalim, but they weren't finished. They took all the booty and they ransacked the city, and they were still going to exact revenge on this group. Et sonam vet bekoram vet kol chelam. Now pasuk lama. Take a look at 30. Vayomer Yaakov al Shimon ve'el Levi, achartem oti lahavisheni biyoshei ba'aretz. You have decomposed me, making me odious among the inhabitants of the land. In other words, you have sullied my reputation, and you will have placed us in danger. Va'ani metei mispar. We are a minority. V'nesfu alai, and they are going to cohort against us. V'hikuni v'nishmadati and v'netiyah. We are going to be absolutely destroyed, eradicated. Was he angry with them that he killed them? What was his anger about?
Fear of retribution.
Retribution. He was fear of vulnerability. He didn't pass judgment on the substance of the killing. We don't know what Yaakov felt one way or the other, but you can surmise from this verse that Yaakov was not as disturbed about the actual act of murder as he was about the consequences for taking revenge against this very important power, which was probably a world power, a regional power in that time. And it's not finished. Do you see any contrition from the sons of Yaakov? What's the verse that the pasuk ends with? Vayomru? Hachzona yaset achotenu. Although some have pointed out that they were very careful to say hachizona, because they didn't want to themselves confirm that their sister was defiled. So it was as if this is what happened to her. They were still preserving her dignity even to the last minute. What is the children's response to Yaakov? The what?
That it's about Dina.
It's about Dina. It's about Dina, right? I think this is, now some of this is mine, some of this I got from others, and some of it I'm making up. So the part that I'm making up, feel free to dispute. But I think that what's happening here is that there's actually a generational tension between Yaakov and his children. And there is a tension that is born out of liberty and freedom and youth versus a person who has been manipulated and tricked, deceived, and lived a life on the run. Well, our experiences shape us. We are who we experience in life. Very few people can step out of their experiences and transform themselves. Yaakov was following a path of an evolving path, and he evolved into a man who meets Esav, who felt, there's no question, and Rabbi Sachs says this so I can feel very comfortable saying it, he felt guilty about this whole deception of stealing the brachot. He wanted to almost pay him back and compensate him by giving him all the wealth that he acquired. He said, look at the buzzer, he says, give it all. And the bowing down was an acquiescence. It was a kind of a deference. It was a way of creating a peaceful relationship, but by miniaturizing or by sublimating his own sense of self. Now here are these tribes, 11 of them, with Dina, who were growing up strong and with vitality and vim and vigor, and they see their father bowing down to their uncle. They were probably, I'm making this part up a little, they were probably horrified. Now, I'm going to go one step further. I think that Shechem, excuse me if I'm going way off, but I think you have to see the parsha in sequence. I think Shechem and the regional power saw Esav and Yaakov's relationship and saw a passive, what they interpreted as docile, deferential man who was willing to make peace almost at any cost. So they then go ahead and abduct Dinah, and they start a negotiation. I mean, you'll see when you get to, when you see the parsha, they negotiate. We'll change. We'll have commerce with each other. We'll open up our markets. We'll all be rich. We'll live in prosperity. Maybe they were sincere. Maybe they weren't. I don't know one way or the other. I don't know much about them. Anyone whose name is Shechem and Hamor, I suspect that they were lacking sincerity and authenticity. But that's a little bit biased on my part. But I think now we're in an era that you can be a little bit more, let us politically correct. So I can say Shechem and Hamor exactly weren't names that sounded like they were representing a great deal of integrity and dignity. So, but it didn't matter. Yaakov was not tricked into taking a relationship, but Yaakov was willing just to take Dinah and leave. Shimon Levi said, no, this will not happen. We are a regional power. The Jews are back in town. We're not going to take this type of aggression against us, because if we take aggression once and we take it twice, then there's no deterrence factor in our enemies, in our relationship. So what's the last line that they say back to him? Vayomru? Hakazonai aseta chotenu? Can we allow this to be promoted and propagated in the population that we are having the Jewish people have this type of humility? And it's interesting, Yaakov doesn't answer them. Doesn't say a word. Until. When does Yaakov get back at them? Vayechi. Yaakov is the king of keeping your powder dry and throw out your cards when you need to throw them out. That was a mess. For a man who started off as Ish Tam Yoshevo Alim, there's a lot to learn how he negotiates. The end of the life, right on his deathbed, he says to Shimon and Levi, Shimon and Levi Achim, Kalei Chamas Besodotehem, Al Tavo Nafshi, was it Besodam Al Tavo Nafshi? You didn't include me in the conversation? And then he ends up with Achalkein B'Yakov, Va'afitzein B'Yisrael. Says that I'm going to divide you up among the Jews and I'm going to spread you out throughout the entire country. Now, before I get to that last piece, which I think has a lot of relevance, I want to get back to the Maral. The Maral on the Shechem story, on Gur Aryeh, and you have it here. No, you don't have it here. Yes, you do. You have it in the second page where the arrow is. This is going to come back to your point exactly about collateral damage and so-called innocence during wartime, which is a very significant issue that the world is grappling with today. Much more so about Israel than apparently any other country on the planet. V'nira d'lo kashamidi. Well, you don't know what the question is because I skipped it. Mishalom d'lo dami shnei umot. Kengo b'nei Yisrael v'kananim. Shem shnei umot k'dichtiv ayinu l'amachad. U'metchila lo nechshu v'lachad l'fichach. Hutar l'lchom k'din umah. According to the Maral, this was not a battle of individuals, but this was a national conflict between nations. I'm reading a little into the Maral, but I think it's an accurate reading. So I'm saying a little bit with some hesitance. I'm making this up a little bit also, but I don't know if the Maral would have been upset had he known that I'm making this part up. What I would like to, just as conjecture, to defend Yaakov in the following way. Yaakov and Esav, which I know you can argue this easily that it's wrong, but just bear with me for a moment. Yaakov and Esav were two brothers battling over their rightful place in a family. Yaakov deceived his brother, he stole the bracha, he bought the bechorah with some soup, and he walked around with this sense of guilt his entire life. Even though you can argue Yaakov represents the Jewish people forever and Esav Rome forever, which is true. In this case, it was a brother versus a brother. Therefore, Yaakov had no right, getting back to your point, to look at the combatants with Esav as rodfim, because Yaakov saw himself as almost a guilty party against his own brother. Skip to the end of the parsha. This is no longer two brothers. This is a nation of Shechem and Hamor and engaged in an unprovoked unilateral attack on the Jewish people. It's nation versus nation. Therefore, I'm not saying this is the law. I'm not. If you're coming from a different point of view, please just take the view and intellectually analyze it. Therefore, Shimon and Levi were legitimately engaged in full-scale war against everyone in the city. Because it was no longer a war versus one person versus another person, it was a nation versus a nation. And when there are nations fighting with each other, then the issue of collateral damage and innocence and citizens and civilians takes on a whole different identity and takes a different type of an approach. It's almost as if it's seen a mechemet, mitzvah mechemet reshut, almost. And therefore, the Maral would be defending Shimon and Levi, because they were not obligated to look carefully at the credentials of the 400 of the Shechem, of Shechem, because those Shechem people were engaged in a national conflict for the survival of the Jewish people. How you want to extrapolate that into some modern term, that is obviously for your own imagination to go one way or the other, either the Rashi camp or the Maral camp at the end of the parasha. But I'm still not finished. So now I want to get now to the Shimon and Levi. Because remember, Shimon and Levi's acts in and of itself, I believe, getting back to it, was a response to Yaakov. I think it's a very plausible that this is what was happening. Certainly we know this from Binyamin, from the Medrash, that Mordechai said, my great-great-great-great-grandfather didn't bow down to Haman. I don't have that. The Jews don't. Remember Menachem Begin? I don't remember when the vernacular was Wailing Wall. Do you remember what Menachem Begin said? I remember this. It's so. I always remember hearing his voice saying it. Anybody remember? You said Golda Meir, so maybe you can fast track yourself a little bit after Golda. Menachem Begin, we're not going to long call it the Wailing Wall, which we don't. He says Jews don't wail anymore. You remember that piece in history? And for those who could remember the Kotel from the 1940s, it was called. I don't. Maybe I tell my students, they think I remember the Gettysburg Address, but I really wasn't that old. So they used to call it the Wailing Wall. And Menachem Begin changed the vernacular. Jews don't wail anymore. So there is a difference between the Eretz Yisrael Jew and the Chutz La'aretz Jew. And there's a lot of conversation around it in the more modern religious Zionist commentaries in this parsha of Vayishlach and the tension of the two. But now I want to skip to get back to Achakem Yaakov Afis and Yisrael, and I have one more point about the brothers. You should know that there is one commentary that I saw, Rav Shaul Yisraeli, who was like the adjunct assistant Rosh Yeshiva of Merkez Harav. There was a little bit of a pecking order. It was Rav Cook, Rav Avram Shapira, and then the third of this trifecta was a man, Rav Shaul Yisraeli, who is in his own right just one of the great religious Zionist thinkers of the generation. He wrote a book called Siach Yisrael, which is a really fascinating book. They put together his Divrei Torah, and very sophisticated thinking and a very poetic Hebrew. So you have to kind of grapple with it a little. Rav Yisraeli says that actually Shimon and Levi were not heroes, and he deconstructs the whole story. He says, "You know how I know they weren't heroes?" He said, not in these words, because I'm being a little bit too harsh on them. He said they were actually self-centered and self-absorbed and a little bit narcissistic. He didn't say any of those words. But I'm using those words to explain his concept. How did he get there? He said, because if you look at the end of this parsha, HaKazonai Yaseachotenu, they were standing up for the pride of Judaism, and they weren't going to let it be injured or tarnished, and they were going to stand up at all costs. They were going to wear their talus in Auschwitz under the Carmelite nuns. They were never going to stop defending the identity of the Jews. Yet it was the same Shimon and Levi who sold Yosef. He said, what kind of brotherhood, Achei Dina, would sell their own brother? See, he said, from the end of the parsha of Vayeshev, you can retroactively look back and see the true character of Shimon and Levi. They were always in it as self-righteous warriors, not as noble warriors. And he said that in a true society of diverse views, there has to be a broader conversation with people that agree and don't agree with us. And by them shutting down Yosef was a way of saying that I will support only those who agree with my point of view. Otherwise, I have a different persona. For those who like to read the editorials in the New York Times or don't like to read the editorials in the New York Times, Nicholas Kristof wrote about liberalism on the college campus. It's in this week's, one of these days this week. I suggest you take a look about what he said about liberals supporting, liberals only supporting views that don't disagree with themselves. And that's a very important point that he says about Shimon and Levi. But I see there are people outside. I have one more minute if that clock is correct. But getting back to Achakem B'Yakov Afitzein B'Yisrael, Rav Shimshon Folher says, and with this I'm going to conclude, he says the biggest bracha that Yaakov gave, the greatest bracha of survival that Yaakov gave his children, was Shimon and Levi, Achakem B'Yakov Afitzein B'Yisrael. Why? He said, because wherever we are, if you put a concentration of Shimon and Levi together, it's combustible. It's powerful. It's dangerous. They're volatile. They're uncontrollable. And they will do harm. But if you split them up, and you throw in a couple of Shimon and Levi's in every community around the Jewish globe, then you have just enough potency and power to stand up for the rights of the Jews in every circumstance. See, it's almost metaphoric, taking that great strength and energy of Shimon and Levi and making sure it's diluted so it should never be used against us, but strong enough that we'll always have their voice when we need it. Which is a little bit, getting back to the parshiot before, and one of my favorite interpretations that I made up also, so you don't have to like this, but I like it. Kol Kol Yaakov V'Yadayim Yedei Esav. I've always looked at that as a way of saying that the Jew needs to have two personas. We have to have the voice, the inner strength of Yaakov, that the man of Tamim, Yosheva Halim, that has to inform and guide us. But sometimes you also need the Daim of the Esav. And if the Esav hands are not linked to the call of Yaakov, then we become destructive. But as long as the call of Yaakov is what's informing the hands of Esav, then the Jew is guaranteed to survive. Getting back to our parsha, this whole parsha is about the conflict of the Jewish people with our neighbors outside of Eretz Yisrael. Inside, there was a lot said. I hope that makes sense to you, and that when you read the parsha, you look at some of this stuff a little bit differently. I'll have to stop here.
Anybody who they don't have their email address and would like to be on the email list.
I want to talk to you.